Today in Studio 360, can a big dose of art improve healthcare in America? Well, there's a doctor who wants his patients to sing through some of the worst pain imaginable.
We chose burn patients because the pain is so severe that we thought if we can prove that music therapy can actually have a positive effect in these patients, it's going to work in every patient.
It was a relief and it was a great thing to have, you know, instead of just sitting there and laying there waiting for them to get done.
And we'll meet some young medical residents trying to learn about their patients by writing about them.
Part of what I had written was about the same patient, and I think for a lot of patients, saying that they're going to give up is very hard. You know, if you had a small chance at living versus no chance at all, what would you choose? Wouldn't anybody choose life?
I'm Kurt Anderson, Art as Medicine. That's ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at scion.com. And by Harvard University Press, publisher of the newly annotated Pride and Prejudice. In this illustrated edition, Patricia Mayer Spax provides commentary that celebrates the novel's enduring pleasures at bookstores now.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Now, try to guess where we are. A cocktail lounge called something like Seasons or Le Cabaret in some upscale downtown hotel somewhere? Nope. We are at a hospital near Buffalo, New York. It's the Roswell Park Cancer Institute. Mark DiGiampaolo is performing in the lobby.
I never have a set lineup. Rather, I just try to come up with a flow of music that seems to make sense for that particular day and for those particular people.
And if this doesn't exactly say chemotherapy to you, that is exactly the point.
I watch as they walk in, and I see the expression on their face, and many of them come in with very challenging situations, whether it's for their own situation or whether they're visiting somebody.
Like hospitals all over the country, Roswell Park is drawing patients with its cultural program. They've installed a huge, brightly painted metal sculpture along with 800 other original works of art all over the hospital. They bring in dancers and actors and musicians to work with patients undergoing treatment. And the very first thing you hear when you walk in the door might be a volunteer performer like Mark.
I've learned with one of the cleaning carts that his wheels are actually in E-flat major. So I see him coming, and there's a couple pieces that I can pick that will actually work with the sound coming out of his wheels as opposed to getting clobbered by it.
Today in Studio 360, we'll look at some of the ways that the creative arts, music and movement and literature are becoming part of healthcare. And we'll hear from people who are trying to prove scientifically that this isn't just civilized and nice, that the arts can actually help people get better. People like Richard Fratayan.
I've always had an interest in music because I play, and there's musical talent in my family, inherited through my mother, and all my children are very musically inclined. But I came to understand that music therapy had a profound effect on patients recovering from all sorts of things.
Dr. Fratayan is director emeritus of the Burn Unit at the Cleveland Metro Health Trauma Center. He experienced music therapy himself a few years ago when he was recovering from surgery to remove a brain tumor, and he became a true believer.
The problem is music therapy is not compensated by either governmental programs or private insurance policies. Because there just isn't very much science in music therapy yet. And so I thought that it might be interesting to see if we could prove the value of music therapy in the burn center where pain and anxiety is really very, very high.
I don't remember coming into the hospital. I just remember waking up and my family was in the room, and I knew I was in bad shape because I was so bandaged up and all these people with white coats standing around me, so I knew I was in bad shape.
A burn injury is so profound that it affects every part of the person. It's not only physical and emotional, but there's an intellectual challenge and there's a spiritual threat, because patients don't recognize who they are anymore. They don't feel the same. They don't look the same. Oftentimes they feel ashamed of how they look, and they're so afraid.
I'm Clifton Dobbs, and I was admitted to the burn unit because I sustained some burns from the barbecue grill that I was trying to light. I had gasoline on my T-shirt because I was filling my lawnmower up about 2 hours earlier. So when I went to light the barbecue grill, just a fume from the T-shirt caught fire. And it just, like, exploded. It, like, went up my arm, and just before I knew it, I was, like, my upper body was, like, totally engulfed in flame. And just when I had done that, my brother Anton came around the corner, and he jumped on top of me and helped put me out.
We chose burn patients because their pain is so severe and their anxiety is so high that we thought if we can prove that music therapy can actually have a positive effect in these patients, then we can be rest assured that it's going to work in every patient.
You know, you have to get your bandages changed 3 times a day, and they actually scrape your skin with this dull instrument, because you have to heal from the inside out. You can't get scabs. They don't want you to do that when you burn because of an infection and all that type of stuff. So every day you have to get scraped 3 times a day. It's very, very painful. Changing bandages are painful. Putting on the different lubrications and stuff are very painful.
Now, obviously, we can give pain medication. We can give sedatives and tranquilizers. But if it's a really painful dressing change, there's no way you can relieve all of the pain except under anesthesia. And you can't anesthetize the patient 2 or 3 times a day. It's the body won't tolerate it.
You know, everybody talks about morphine, 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 but it was like did nothing to deaden the pain, in my view. You know, it was just, I mean, maybe it did. Maybe if you went in there with absolutely nothing, it would be much worse. I can't imagine it, but I, you know, I mean, I could feel everything.
Music requires an integration of many parts of the brain. There's the motor part, that is the physical response to playing or tapping to the rhythm of the music and that sort of thing. But then there's the limbic system, the emotional response that comes to hearing music that brings forth feelings and thoughts and ideas. And but also there's rhythm, there's tempo, there's melody. All of these things have to be integrated at the same time to appreciate music. It's amazing how the brain can do this. The reason we need a professional music therapist to intervene in these painful procedures is by their training, they're able to capture the patient's attention. We call that entrainment. It is actively involving the patient in the musical experience, because when their mind is diverted to participating in the therapy, they cannot think about the pain.
Sorry, one more time.
She had these different instruments that she would bring in, and she would tell me to sing along with her.
Amazing grace.
And I did.
How sweet.
I started singing along with her, and it really did take your mind off of the immediate, what the nurses were doing. And it was a relief, and it was a great thing to have, you know, instead of just sitting there and laying there waiting for them to get done.
Was blind, but now I see.
The earlier research just you know, ask the patient before and after a musical experience, do you feel better? Yes, sure. That doesn't really prove anything. It's only when you're dealing with patients like we're dealing with in the burn unit that you can clearly identify changes in their response with music therapy. And we have done that. And one of our latest studies is utilizing measurements of a stress hormone, which is one of the products of the adrenal gland, in response to stress. And we know when patients are highly stressed, these levels go up. And we're measuring to see whether music therapy can actually depress those levels of the hormone. And our initial studies have shown that. What we're doing is new. We know that, and that's why it's exciting, because it is new. But the music can have a calming effect on people. How it works, still being discovered. I once was lost, but now I'm found.
Yeah, and I know that's the look I get from a lot of people. But I mean, I like the grill, and so I do. If you would taste some of my grilled meats and stuff, you would understand.
That's Clinton Dobbs, a former patient of the burn unit, and we heard also from Dr. Richard Fratayan of the Cleveland Metro Health Trauma Center. Carrie Hillman produced our story. Today in Studio 360, we're talking about whether and how the arts can actually improve healthcare. Joining me now is Jill Sonkey, who's been studying this question for years. She's a dance therapist and the director of the Center for the Arts in Healthcare at the University of Florida. Jill, during the 15 years that you've been in this field, you must have regularly encountered people who say, yeah, that's all very nice, but where's the science? and what do you say when people say that?
Well, as we've just heard, the science is there. There is a growing body of research supporting the efficacy of the arts in healthcare, including in patient outcomes. It's not as extensive as it needs to be. We do need much more research, and we need more, you know, randomized controlled studies to help us understand not just what we've kind of always known as human beings, that the arts help us to feel better and that they're enjoyable, but why they help. And we're beginning to see research looking at, can the arts make a difference in the cost of healthcare? There's one, I think, really remarkable and important study that just came out of Florida State University in their music program. Their musicians work with young patients who are undergoing procedures such as spinal taps. And the music therapists meet with the patient ahead of time. They understand what type of music the patient likes. And then during the procedure, they play music for them. And they've found that through reductions in staff time, the need to have an RN present, and a reduction in a need for sedation and pain medications, that they, during the term of their study, saved an average of, I think it was $567 per procedure. So the potential cost savings are quite significant.
Talk to me about the placebo effect and how that became a kind of key in turning around some scientifically oriented people's mindsets.
Well, I think when Candace Pert and others helped us to understand the placebo effect, which simply means that if you think something is happening in your body, that to some extent it can actually happen in your body. And thus the science of psychoneuroimmunology helped us to understand the connection between the mind and the body.
So it sort of took the new aginess out of the equation, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. It helps us to understand the historical roles of the arts in healing traditions. You know, when you assert your belief system in any way, you can have an impact on your body. When you're really actively engaged, that idea of entrainment that was mentioned earlier, when you're fully engaged in something and really focusing your intention and your belief system on something, it can have an effect in the body.
So you were trained as a dance therapist when the field was still fairly new. When you would walk into a hospital room ready to dance, would patients say, "What the heck is going on here? Did they think you were nuts?"
A lot of them did. When I think back, in the beginning, people really did think it was weird. You know, I got very strange looks as I was padding around the hospital in dance attire, you know, and people would see me dancing with patients through the windows of rooms.
I was delirious if I saw that, I think.
Absolutely. So people kind of thought it was strange. And then we sort of went into a second phase of my experience in the field where people really thought it was nice. You know, it's just so nice that you're coming in to do this. And then as we, you know, had been here long enough and as people were seeing the difference that the arts were making for patients, people, meaning the healthcare environment, I think really began to see the arts as important contributors to healthcare.
Jill Sonkey is the director of the Center for the Arts and Healthcare Research and Education at the University of Florida, and we'll talk again later in this hour. Coming up, a freshly minted doctor fills some holes in her medical education.
We're learning about people's deaths and births and life-changing illnesses, and there's no textbook that says this is how to talk to a patient or this is how to understand a patient.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion offers options that let everyone express his or her creativity to customize their car to fit their lives. Creativity begins at Scion.com. And by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting a Baroque holiday with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, with special guests Michaela Petri, recorder, and Lars Hannibal, archlute, on Sunday, December 15th at 5. Broadcast times are available through local PBS listings.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. For a few decades, physician authors have been regularly showing up on the bestseller lists, not just writing books about how to be healthy, but accounts of their lives as doctors. Chris Adrian is a novelist who takes some of the experiences he's had as a doctor and turns them into stories. Not realistic stories, but strange, sometimes dark fantasies. In his novel, The Children's Hospital, a hospital becomes a kind of floating ark during an apocalyptic flood. Adrian says that writing helps him deal with the emotional burden of his work with patients. He's a pediatric oncologist, a children's cancer doctor.
There was something really extraordinary about being thrust into the middle of these catastrophes that these kids and their parents were encountering and undergoing, and then in some very real sense getting to watch how they reacted. There was something incredibly moving and lovely and profound that made me realize I was getting to see these people in some ways at their absolute best.
Chris Adrian took a leave from his University of California hospital to go and get a degree in theology. And while doing that, he wrote another book of fiction.
This is a story that's part of a novel that's a retelling of A Midsummer Night's Dream that takes place about, a year or two ago in Buena Vista Park in San Francisco.
In Shakespeare's play, the fairy king and queen are struggling for possession of a human boy.
And over the course of this story, he gets leukemia, and they take him down the street to the hospital to get treatment.
It took them both a long time to understand that the boy was sick, though she would point out that she had been the first to notice he was unhappy and had sought to remedy his discontent with sweeter treats and more delightful distractions. She thought it was evidence that she loved him more, that she had first noticed that something was wrong, and she said as much to her husband when they were still trying to outdo each other in love for the child.
At some point in the story, Titania tries furiously to heal the boy using whatever magic is at her disposal, but discovers that there's an inverse relationship between how much she cares about somebody and how much she's able to affect them with her magic. And so she ends up healing a number of other kids on the ward just from spillover, but is able to do nothing for the child that she's come to hold as her own.
The ward was almost the ugliest place she had ever seen, and certainly the ugliest place she had ever lived. Someone had tried some time ago to make it pretty, so there were big photographs in the hall of children at various sorts of play, and some of these were diverting, she supposed, but the pictures were few. In other places on the wall, someone had thought to put up bas-relief cartoon faces about the size of a child's face, but the faces looked deformed to her eye. Goblin faces. And they seemed uniformly to be in pain.
Making the parents, not just any parents, but Titania and Oberon, was to try and get at how enormously powerful these parents seem sometimes when they're in the throes of this catastrophe, and how easy it is to appreciate how much they love their kids. And yet, for me, there was something really jarring about how completely helpless they seem at the same time.
She peered at the parents, imagining their hearts like machines, manufacturing surfeit upon surfeit of love for their children, and then wondered how something could be so awesome and so utterly powerless. A feeling like that ought to be able to move mountains.
Obviously, since you're a doctor, you've been headed down this path of medicine, pre-med, for many years. Have you also been a writer of fiction for many years? How did those things happen in parallel tracks?
When I was five, my mom gave me a stethoscope for my birthday and made it pretty clear that I was supposed to use it in a professional capacity when I grew up.
Mom gave me a typewriter, so there you go.
And I got sick when I was a young teenager and was in the hospital for like 5 days or almost a week. And during that time, my dad brought me Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars series in a big box, and it was covered with scantily clad men and women and floating ships on the cover of this box set. And I, within half of the first book, I was hooked.
So there you were in a hospital bed reading fantasy. I guess your life was pretty well established at that moment.
Funny. I've never actually considered that before, but it's true.
You find yourself in this, to my eye, somewhat perverse loop of being a doctor, practicing this grueling kind of medicine, and then instead of writing your fantastic stories to escape that, sort of recycling that experience in this other extraordinary way. Is there anything you do, paint bad paintings, go to dumb movies to entirely escape this loop you've created for yourself?
I don't know. If you're a senior doctor, it's easy to try and tell people to tell your charges to take care of themselves, but much harder to tell them what to do. For me, I think that I've learned to appreciate any time, not just out of the hospital, I guess, but any time just away from that whole world where sick and dying children are an everyday reality, and to sort of notice when that's receded and pay more attention to it. And that may be time with my partner, time with the dog, or time standing in line at the DMV. And that, I think, can also serve to remind you that no matter how thoroughly immersed as a professional you are in other people's problems, they're not your problems when it comes down to it. And that's in some ways a terrible thing. But if you cock your head a little and look at it in a slightly different light, it's a relief.
It's also why we read fiction, partly to experience other people's problems in a deep way. And then we close the book and they're not our problems.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Adrian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris Adrian's forthcoming novel is called The Great Night. We heard Anne-Marie Nest reading an excerpt. there are some people in the medical community who think that all doctors could use a little more fiction in their lives.
My name is Nellie Herman, and I work in the program in narrative medicine at Columbia Medical School.
Narrative medicine has been a movement in medical schools and hospitals for more than a decade. At Columbia University, Nellie Herman works with OBGYN residents. She has them read stories by writers like Jamaica Kincaid and Raymond Carver, and then they do creative writing exercises themselves.
The reaction I usually get is, what does that have to do with doctors? Why would doctors need to know how to write?
We sent Aaron Davis to Columbia to find out.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Abigail Ford is a big reader, though you'd never guess it. She just doesn't seem like the kind of person who has time to kick back with a novel.
I'm just putting some gel here, some ultrasound transmission gel, to see if I can hear the baby's heart rate. You hear that?
Yeah.
There it goes. That's the first time you're hearing it, right?
Uh-huh.
Cool. All right, well, everything sounds great. So I wouldn't worry too much about the headaches. My name is Abigail Ford, and I am a chief resident in obstetrics and gynecology at Columbia. And here we're in my continuity clinic, which is where I see OB and GYN patients throughout the course of the year.
So, hey, Francis.
It's hectic.
Do we have anybody else?
It's pretty busy here. As residents, we learn clinical information. We're learning statistics and procedures. We are reading and writing all the time, reading charts, reading labs, writing notes. Just writing her prescription. We're speaking all the time. And I think we're pretty much up to date with all your labs. I'm just going to see you back in a month. We're learning about people's deaths and births and life-changing illnesses. And there's no textbook that says this is how to talk to a patient or this is how to understand a patient.
And this is where Nellie Herman comes in. She has a totally different way of getting doctors to think about patient care.
I think it would be a little stale to read something that was written by a doctor about doctoring.
Nellie teaches narrative medicine at Columbia, and she leads a workshop in the hospital for residents like Dr. Ford. Now, narrative medicine is almost like a regular writing class. The group reads a short story, and they discuss it, and there's always a writing prompt. Unlike a typical workshop, many of these writers are coming directly from a lecture about angiogenesis, or how tumors grow new veins. These classes aren't packed. Only 8 of the 20 residents are at today's meeting.
I think there's probably a handful of people who don't come just because they don't think it's worth their time.
For the students who have come, Dr. Ford reads something that everyone in the room has heard before. They're supposed to keep this idea in mind during the reading.
The residents must be able to provide patient care that is compassionate, appropriate, and effective for the treatment of health.
She looks up and asks the class.
Anybody want to read?
Our mother called us brothers, her dirty little boys. Us brothers, boys were made, our mothers like to say, in the muddy image of our father.
We chose a story called Good Brother by Peter Marcus. It's about a family who lives in a really dirty, nasty town by a gross river.
When our father told us we were leaving, he meant it. We were leaving for good, this dirty river, this dirty town.
The parents, they really want to move. The boys really don't want to move because it's all they've ever known. At the end of the story, sort of as a reaction to the idea of moving, one of the brothers has an idea.
Give me your hand, I told him. Hold your hand up against the wood.
He gathers up a bunch of nails.
This might sting, I warned. And then I raise back that hammer.
And starts to nail his brother's hands to the fishing pole.
I drove that rusty nail right through brother's hand. Good brother, I said.
And the father comes out, sees what they're doing, and just turns his back and goes back inside.
Our father turned back his back. Us brothers turned back to face each other. I raised back the hammer. I lined up that rusted nail.
Do you have any sort of gut reactions to reading this?
Nobody cringed at the thought of a rusty nail plunging through the boy's skin. In fact, the first thing out of their mouths, tetanus shots.
Had their tetanus shots.
Pretty much what came to mind.
Pretty quickly, it becomes clear that the residents are really drawn to the boys, and they start to see their patients in the story.
It's their perspective of, you know, this is their world that they actually like this way.
When I read the story, I thought about geriatrics patients. And what I thought of was, like, how many times you see geriatrics patients going to homes that are, like, not in the best of shape, and you always say, why don't you just go to this home, or why don't you know, and they never want to go because it's home for them.
And
And in the story, obviously, the parents don't make any effort to find out what it is that makes them so attached to this place that they would nail themselves to it.
I feel like sometimes we do end up doing that with patients. Like, they're clearly ignoring our advice and doing what we think is bad, and we say, okay, well, we'd really rather you do this, and just ignore the fact that they're nailing themselves to their home or the telephone pole.
Right, and I think that's a good question, is how can you do it better? Instead of just turning your back, how do you reach that patient? So I want you to think of a patient that maybe was hard for you or that you didn't quite have the same language, and to try and write from their perspective. Try and write in their voice.
Everybody loves a good story, but that's not exactly what narrative medicine is all about. It's about seeing how the physician or nurse or social worker actually becomes a part of other people's personal narratives, the story of their lives.
When you have an illness and a doctor enters the scene, I don't think it's ridiculous to say that it's a dramatic moment in your story. What this work is about is trying to get the doctors to recognize that and read their patients' stories appropriately.
Maria Schiavone is a first-year resident. She's petite and has to fold the cuffs of her doctor's coat up above her wrists. She volunteers to read. You should know that the patient she's writing about had just passed away from endometrial cancer. Many of the other residents had also seen her.
I'm speaking, I wrote it like in the frame of the...
We all wrote about the same patient.
I'm not ready to die. Why do these people keep asking me to sign away my right to live? I've told them hundreds of times. I want to be resuscitated. I want to be intubated. I made a promise to my mother to be present for my father's memorial. I think I can hold out a bit longer. The rest of the medication, sticks, pokes, tubes, I can probably do without. But I just want to last a little longer. I'm not ready to die.
Part of what I had written was about the same patient. And I think for a lot of patients, saying that they're going to give up is very hard. You know, if you had a small chance at living versus no chance at all, what would you choose? Wouldn't anybody choose life?
Even knowing all you know now as a doctor, would you make the same decision? I might make the same decision as a patient. That's what's scary to me. Yeah. Just being in, like, different roles. Like, as the doctor, you're kind of like...
The conversation continues until their hour is up. These residents have a really busy schedule to keep. It's hard to say whether their focus extends beyond the classroom or if it's just immediately washed away by the data and urgency of their work. It's a hard thing to measure, in writing anyway.
We all go into this field with these ideas about being a team with patients, and we go through medical school thinking, you know, we're never going to be that doctor that's, like, not taking into account the patient's perspective. And this is a good reminder, I think, to step back and say, okay, yeah, this is where I started. Am I still becoming the kind of doctor that I wanted to be?
For Studio 360, I'm Erin Davis.
And I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Joining me again is Jill Sonkey. She is a professor at the University of Florida and an advocate for the arts in healthcare. How common are these kinds of programs these days?
They are becoming very, very common. The arts, the visual arts in particular, as well as literature, have always been used in the teaching of medicine. And now I think healthcare overall is becoming more holistic, and there's an interest in really humanizing the healthcare experience. So the physical environment is really, really changing in healthcare design.
Well, an architect friend of mine who has worked in hospitals trying to design from scratch environments that are not so dreary said to me that she had the sense that because everybody expects hospitals to be horrible, that became a self-fulfilling prophecy for many years, and they were designed to be dreary and awful.
Well, they were designed to visually represent technical capability for a while.
Right.
I mean, I think, you know, we came through the industrial era where schools, hospitals, you know, were very sterile clinical places. But then, you know, as our technologies began to become very important aspects of healthcare for people, we wanted to sort of showcase, you know, those technologies.
What about individual artists themselves who are involved, who get involved in these programs? Are there certain kinds of artists or kinds of people, other than the nice ones as opposed to the not nice ones, who work well in these healthcare contexts and don't?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. Those artists who become really good hospital artists are really excellent facilitators. They aren't always the very, very most outstanding artists, although certainly proficiency is very important. But you really have to be a good facilitator, and you really have to be able to navigate the healthcare system.
Meaning dealing with a kind of very regimented bureaucracy?
Exactly. The arts and medicine are different cultures,
yeah,
for sure. I mean, you know, artists often, you know, don't want to wear a stinking badge,
yeah,
you know, don't choose to, you know, place themselves within bureaucracies. And not every artist can come into a healthcare environment, respect it, and work effectively within it. And it's really important to be able to do that, to be an effective artist in a healthcare environment.
As healthcare and elder care remains one of the most robust parts of our economy, it sounds like this is all just a secret jobs program for artists who are good facilitators.
Well, it's true. I mean, you know, I am in the College of Fine Arts at the University of Florida, and when we established the Center for the Arts and Healthcare in 1996, one of the things that our, you know, EPR administration, our deans were very interested in was the arts and healthcare as a career option for artists, another way for artists to be employed in their communities.
Jill Sunke, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Jill Sunke is the director of the Center for the Arts in Healthcare Research and Education at the University of Florida. Coming up, we don't really believe everything we see on TV, do we?
People sometimes have those same expectations. Why aren't I getting the MRI? They did it on ER. They did it on Grey's Anatomy.
Out the door, just in time.
Doctors on Television, that's coming up. Stat in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On this coming Monday, Studio 360 will be live on stage in New York City, and it's going to be awesome. And you can watch live online. The astrophysicist Jenna Levin and the amazing comedian and musician Reggie Watts will attempt to unlock the secrets of the universe. That's Monday at 7:30 Eastern, live on Studio360.org. But on today's show, we are talking about art and medicine. The cost of healthcare in America is, of course, a huge national political issue, an issue that we're talking and talking about, but not really squarely addressing yet. We pay a lot more than any other country for our healthcare, although we don't seem to be getting more for our money. Now, you can blame the way doctors are reimbursed, you can blame the insurance industry, you can blame the general hodgepodge of American healthcare, neither a free market nor a public system. Or you can blame Hollywood.
I'm Dr. Billy Goldberg. I'm an emergency medicine physician. It's strange, but I think people get their information from TV more than anywhere else. And what they see on TV is what kind of they expect in the hospital. And a show like House, for example, they do everything. And, you know, often unrealistically come up with the answer every time. They're never wrong.
Schistocyte suggests TTP.
Good.
Now what?
Normally we try plasmapheresis, but the patient has an albumin colloid allergy.
So?
So that means we have to give him a splenectomy.
Yes, it does.
It's interesting. We take boards in emergency medicine where when you finish your training, you test on the boards, and it's kind of this artificial encounter. And you can order anything. And we do order anything on those cases. And that's kind of like what happens on TV. There's no restrictions. You know, there's no downsides to the test. There's no negatives. There's no cost involved.
Testing, of course, does increase the cost of health care. That's not to say that it shouldn't be done. My name is Joseph Turo. I'm a professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communication of the University of Pennsylvania. The notion that health care cannot be totally unlimited is something that we don't often discuss in the context of television drama. Of course, nowadays we hear some of that in news programming. But what drama does that news doesn't do is drama brings people behind the scenes. It gives people an emotional connection to certain kinds of realities, even more than news. And when drama shows that the best way to get care is gung-ho, full speed ahead, not thinking about cost, that's the kind of message that people, I think, would say, I want that.
People sometimes have those same expectations. Why aren't I getting the MRI? They did it on ER. They did it on Grey's Anatomy. Why aren't I getting that test? And the truth is it's not available to us 24/7, or it might not be the right thing for you.
Medical dramas of the 60s, with all their faults, and there were many, had the physician as a kind of conduit to learning about the patient. The center of the show was the patient.
Come on, Miss Boyd. You've got to help, too.
I can't. Why can't you get her through that sick, stupid skull of yours? I can't. I just can't. I can't move, and I never will.
Except to kill yourself. Like last night. You managed to get yourself over the rail. You moved. But you say you can't. Well, I say you can. You can if you want to badly enough.
Saying Elsewhere took the idea of focusing on the professionals, the sort of upscale type of person that the networks wanted to reach for their advertisers. And the idea was if we focus on them, people like them will want to watch. And so the patients became less and less important. And then, of course, that carried over to ER, Chicago Hope, and Grey's Anatomy, and Private Practice.
Forget everything that's happened or hasn't happened between us. What I'm about to say to you is strictly professional. As a physician, your girlfriend sucks.
I don't think we can make a one-to-one relationship between the way people, what people see on television and what people literally do in real life. I think what television does is it creates certain ideas of norms. What is the best approach to a certain aspect of life? Whom would we want care from if we had a choice? How do doctors talk about patients behind the scenes?
I've heard that people don't like when doctors talk about their romantic lives or when they talk about other things during surgery or in the ER. But that is our reality. So our water cooler happens to be sometimes to be the operating room.
Grandinetti's is gone. Seattle Institution. Dr. Warren, you ever been there?
A couple times. Good scampi.
Yeah, the place is so romantic. Perfectly lit, intimate. Those cozy little booths, you know, in back.
A 3L silk tie, please.
A little too intense for a first date, though. Bailey, where would you go on a first date?
Isn't there a dying child somewhere?
Nope. I had some time, and I wanted to observe one of these.
They're always having sex in the hospital. If I had that much sex, I would never have been able to make it through medical school. I would have been exhausted.
I'm no Superman.
A lot of doctors say they love Scrubs because Scrubs replicates the kind of pace of the hospital that doctors remember when they were residents.
And yes, the comedy part of it is wonderful, but there's a quirkiness to the hospital, kind of a bizarre gallows humor that we have, and that was exemplified really well in a show like Scrubs.
You know that before medicine ever became a business, the only rule was to do your best to help the patient.
Like it or not, medicine is a business. If the hospital shuts down, who are we helping then?
You know, some of the insurance issues that we often deal with were brought up on that show, where they try and lie about a patient's illness to keep him in the hospital longer because they know that if he doesn't, he's not going to get his procedure. So they dealt with a lot of real issues in a very bizarre way.
Well, I'm new here, but I'm relatively certain that invasive vascular procedures have a very low success rate on dead people.
That TIPS procedure was for Mrs. Blitt down in 103. You see, she doesn't have insurance. Mr. Martinez, on the other hand, had great insurance. Should I talk slower or go get a nurse who speaks fluent moron?
It somehow captures the emotional side of medicine, some of these complex emotions that you don't really have an answer to, the feeling that you don't always know it all and that you're expected to know it all.
What's going to happen to me?
You're going to be okay.
That's what's going to happen. Everything's okay.
That's from the musical episode of the show Scrubs. You can watch the scene at our website, studio360.org. We heard from Billy Goldberg, who's an emergency room physician, and from Joseph Turo, the author of Playing Doctor, Television, Storytelling, and Medical Power. Studio 360's Eric Malinsky produced our story.
I'm going to be okay.
That's what's going to happen.
Everything's okay.
To close the show today, we'll look at a key piece of medical design, a piece of design that has been a true lifesaver. Until the development of dialysis, kidney failure was basically a death sentence. During the last few decades, not just the lifespan, but the quality of life of a person with kidney failure has improved tremendously. In this week's Design for the Real World, a registered nurse, Janice Breen, walks us through how the design of dialysis machines has evolved. She started working with them back in 1973.
I remember that my girlfriend called me up and she said, did you know they opened up a dialysis unit? And I remember walking in, there were 12 dialysis machines, and all I saw were red lines, which were the blood lines. That was my first impression. Oh my God, what is it doing? The 70s machines were huge. You know the double-decker washing machines they have now? The washer on the bottom, the dryer on the top. The bottom portion, we had to fill with 120 gallons of water. The top part is where the coil went into. That was the dialyzer. And the patient was hooked up. There was a huge blood pump, 12 by 12. With this big pump head going around. It was crude at that time. There were moments when the coils used to rupture. Once a coil ruptured on me. So picture all this blood over on the ceiling, in your hair. And if a patient panics and goes, oh, now it's spurting. Once a patient starts dialysis, the only way out or off of dialysis is either you regain your function, which is unlikely, you get a transplant, or you die. A nurse and her patient on dialysis, you have a certain bond, because for the rest of your life, I'm going to see you and you're going to see me. Top of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, was the home program. Push was on to go at home. And I used to train people, and it was wonderful. Because I think people do better on home dialysis. They're educated, they're taking care of themselves, they're responsible for themselves. The machine started to scale down. For home use, it was like a piece of furniture. 3 foot high by maybe a foot and a half deep. But it was still mechanical. Heavy. You could not pick it up. It had a piston in the back that went psh, psh, psh. The knowledge was out on how dialysis works. So now let's hone in on these machines. Make them more efficient. Make them safer. Have alarms. Have an air detector alarm. That's the first alarm I saw. And when I saw it, I said, oh my God, we were doing this without that? So too, though, did the technical end increase. They were no longer simple workhorses. They were very temperamental, make you want to kick them, say, I want my old machine back. But that was part of the technology coming in. The machines today are about 5 foot tall on wheels. It looks like tall R2-D2 because it's got that little arm sticking out. Does it have flashing lights like R2? Yeah, they go on and off at certain times. Does it make boop, 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 boop noises? Yeah, it does, because it's all computer chips. Set it, run it, it does it. Yet it's still a machine. The patient will have a symptom before the machine picks it up. If somebody yawns, I will turn around and say, who yawned? Because that's an indication, usually, that their blood pressure is dropping before it registers on the machine. Cramping. The machine doesn't know I'm getting leg cramps. The machine doesn't know that I need my hand to be held right now. The machine doesn't know when a patient's crying. I may want to change my goals for that patient because I don't like the way the patient looks. That's my nurse sense. If you know somebody who's on dialysis, they have a very, very rough life. The advancements are good. That's come so far. Still not that every patient feels 100%. They don't. As a nurse, you have to regard your patient as your own. And you have to constantly ask yourself, would I treat my family differently? No. Then you're good, Janice. Then you're good.
Janice Breen is a manager at Renal Care Registered Nursing Services in Nanuet, New York. Greta Cohn produced our story. And that is it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Eric Malinsky,
Rob Weisberg,
Michael Guerriero,
Max Bass,
Julia Botero,
Georgette Pierre.
Thanks to Faith McClellan of the World Health Organization, Joyce Kryzak of WBFO, and, as ever, WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org. And by Scion. Scion offers options that let everyone express his or her creativity to customize their car to fit their lives. Creativity begins at Scion.com. Studio 360 series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at Sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
It's not as if we should be scared of Big Brother. Big Brother should be scared of all of us. So the fact that citizens are in a better position to watch their government is a good thing.
In the internet age, who's watching whom? The new art and technology of surveillance. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.